I believe you that we talked about this, but you have to be generous with me, Arthur. You've forgotten about many things I've talked to you about.
That is why I am generous.
It's mostly because I just talk a lot.
I should remember more of it, seeing as how I edited it.
You
all
listened to it three times. Yeah, yeah, if anyone's supposed to follow it, it's you.
Hello, and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur. I'm a filmmaker here in Utah, and, you know, I just need to let it go. Let it go.
That sounds like a good title for a song. Could be a hit.
We could make millions.
And I am Andrew, professional film historian. And sometimes all I want to do is just snap my tether and drift away into outer space. And then, you know, the ghost of George Clooney brings me back.
Oh my God.
And
it took me a second to remember that Gravity was one of my favorite films from this year.
Wow.
And this is a podcast where we watch and discuss a classic film that I have not seen.
But I most likely have.
From every year. This week, we're in 2013. We're watching The Dance of Reality, directed by Alejandro Jodorowsky. For any new listeners, you can find where our movies are streaming or available to rent online down in the link in our show notes. I don't think this is streaming anywhere right now. Andrew and I watched this together on Blu-ray.
Yes, this is a bit of a tougher film to find.
It's on Mubi, so if you have Mubi. What is going on in 2013 in the world? Pope Francis is elected. Do you remember in Bangladesh, this garment factory collapsed?
I do.
Kills over 1,000 people. I remember this because I was working at Banana Republic at the time, and I think we were sourcing our clothes from them or something, and they had this meeting in the back room where they were like, if there are protests outside our store, they had like this whole contingency plan. It was weird.
Were there any?
No. No one cared.
No one cared.
As terrible as that is.
But also, how are you supposed to care about every single thing that happens in the world?
Do you care that Edward Snowden became internationally famous this year for leaking NSA wiretapping information?
I do care. Where is he now?
I don't know. If I click on his Wikipedia article, it's very long, so our listeners can do that research.
Yeah, look it up.
There are protests in Egypt following the coup of the president there. A little follow-up from the Arab Spring that recently happened. Do you remember the meteor that struck across the Russian sky in 2013? Dramatic footage of this online.
Oh, that I don't think I ever saw.
I know in Utah, we just had a meteor streak across our skies and cause a big boom. But this was much bigger and more destructive, actually. I don't believe it actually hit the ground. Maybe it did. But the explosion of the thing in the sky as it's streaking through the atmosphere, that's what causes the big shockwaves that actually does the damage, hurts people, destroys buildings, that kind of thing.
Yes, it was 29.7 kilometers above the ground when it burst.
The Boston Marathon bombing happens this year, the first major terrorist attack on U.S. soil since 9/11.
You know what I always think of when I think of this? That Rolling Stone cover. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
The Rolling Stone did an article on the Boston Marathon bomber, and their cover photo was like a model shoot of the Boston Marathon bomber. They made him look like a rock star.
Yep. Rolling Stone defense cover featuring Boston Marathon bombing suspect. Yeah, they make him look really sexy, don't they? Wow. I believe ISIS is also rising to prominence in the Middle East during this time. You know, there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on.
We are now getting to a point in history that is way closer to home and way harder to interpret in any sort of storytelling way, because we're in the middle of the story and there are certain threads that have not ended. So it's hard to know where any of this will take place in the grander scheme of things.
You know what? Let's not get bogged down in history. We could talk about that for a while. Let's get bogged down in movies.
Oh.
What do you think's at the very top of the box office this year with $1.2 billion?
Now, we are finally at the point where I just literally have no idea, but I'm guessing that figure belongs to Frozen.
That's true. It's Frozen.
In 2013, I've given up on the Oscars. I've given up on the box office. All of my old connections to film are like gone. And now my new connections are through festival circuits and just going to the movies whenever I can and seeking out recommendations. I have found my people. I have found the circle that I trust. And this is sort of where I am today now. So like,
Andrew has fallen into his niche.
Yes, but it's a very wide niche.
You have seen a lot, more than me.
I still watch a lot of movies.
Yes, and Frozen was the film that my niece absolutely loved for forever and always. What do you think's number two at the box office? Any guesses there?
I have no guess. The Hunger Games Catching Fire.
No, it's Iron Man 3.
Oh, I actually liked that one.
I have no strong opinions, truly.
I liked that it was a film that, and I mean, the first film kind of does this as well, but this one was way more on the nose, that the real villain isn't the Middle East or like this weird mythological thing that the news creates. It's these white billionaires in our own country.
There's things to like about a lot of the Marvel films. What about number three, Despicable Me 2?
I haven't seen.
Now, I know you're a huge fan of the Minions. A huge fan.
I don't even
know. So I think you might have some strong opinions about Despicable Me 2. No?
I haven't seen a single Despicable Me or Minions movie. I have not seen a single one of them. And I guess that was my fault, my bad, because now there's too many to catch up on, but it has absolutely gained a crazy amount of traction in modern pop culture.
It's become its own thing. I did see the first Despicable Me, so that is one film that I have seen that Andrew hasn't.
There we go.
Mark that Ding. Down, everyone. I remember laughing. I thought it was funny. All the way at number four is The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
I had such a huge headache when I saw this movie, like a physical, nauseous reaction to this thing.
It's so sad. It's so sad. And yeah, I didn't even bother with the third one. Yeah. I know you didn't either.
Never saw it.
It's just a tragedy after Lord of the Rings was, you know, the greatest trilogy of all time by some measure.
Did you see The Wind Rises in theaters?
I did.
Yes.
And I love that film. I love that film so much.
Hmm.
We'll get another one someday.
You think so?
Yeah. He's back, baby. He's out of retirement. He's making another film.
Is that true?
That's true.
Will he finish it? I don't know. Did you see Pacific Rim in theaters?
And I saw Pacific Rim in theaters. You know I did. I love me some giant monster bullshit. Hell yeah. We did a whole Patreon episode on Guillermo del Toro, and I had strong opinions on Pacific Rim, but I said I would go rewatch it, and I since have rewatched it. And you know what? I like it. It's great. What are some obscure recommendations that you've got?
My first recommendation for this year is The Machine Which Makes Everything Disappear. And I am going to butcher this director's name. Her name is Tinatin Gucciani. She is Georgian, as in the country of Georgia. And this is a documentary about her bringing a big, big camera into her very small farmland hometown and bringing a bunch of people who've never really seen a big movie camera and having them go into a room and talk about themselves in front of this camera. It is a very charming, delightful film. The interviews are all really, they range from silly to emotional, but the whole movie is about how people will change when they realize that a camera is in front of them.
Mm.
It was a great little documentary I watched at Sundance. The director came out and spoke afterwards, and she was very pleasant, and it was just a really great day at the movies. I also was sitting next to three authentic Georgian people, and it turns out they were the three people who owned the Blue Plate, that nice little brunch place that is now closed.
Aww.
So that was a very nice thing, and they spoke to the director in Georgian. I think my experience with this movie is one of the reasons it sticks out for me, but I did very much enjoy the film as well. It touched me. Next up is Jonathan Glazer's sci-fi cult classic, Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson.
Ooh.
This is a movie about an alien, maybe, who is disguised as Scarlett Johansson and is capturing random men who are flirting with her and want to have sex with her and bring them into this lair. But the movie is not really a narrative. It is very much a visual experimentation, and it's sort of an analysis of how someone who is unfamiliar with Earth would take in Earth visually and learn to understand the way things work. But most of it is presented with no dialogue. It is a movie that very much rewards you for paying attention and sticking it through to the end. I love the ending of this movie quite a bit.
Ask the question, what is the human body?
Yes.
I just recently rewatched Under the Skin, maybe a couple weeks ago, and I really enjoyed it on my revisit.
Next up, I'm going to recommend... It's funny you bring up revisiting Under the Skin and enjoying it a lot on the second viewing, because I think the film Only God Forgives, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, was completely misunderstood when it was released. Everyone went into it thinking they wanted to see Drive again.
I did.
And that was kind of a fair expectation, because it's the same director and lead actor and kind of the same creative team. And the marketing for the film was definitely making it look like it was going to be some sort of noir-esque. But this movie is a comedy, and people really weren't ready for that. It's a very obscure art house comedy, and it doesn't always give you its laughs. It has this campy quality to it that's really great, but the movie is just gorgeous to look at. The narrative is very tread material, in my opinion, but it's very aware of that, so it's trying to present it to you in an aesthetically pleasing and surprising way, and I think it absolutely succeeds. I also think Kristen Scott Thomas is incredible in this. Ryan Gosling is who I meant when I said lead actor earlier. And I'm going to mess his name up, but I love him in this movie so much. I'm going to say it. Vitaya Pansigam, he is the mob boss who gets the karaoke scenes, and he is having the time of his life in this movie. He is such an entertaining villain. He is so fun to watch. He's not even really a villain by the end. You're kind of like, wait, yeah, like kind of screw this whole family, right? So if you saw Only God Forgives once in theaters expecting Drive and have your whole life ever since thought, I just hated that, you should give it a revisit and open your mind, because I think that movie is great. It's probably my second favorite Refn after The Neon Demon. And then next up is The Truth About Emmanuel, directed by Francesca Gregorini. This movie makes me cry every time I watch it. Wonderful performances from Caius Gotilario and Jessica Biel. It is a movie about a young woman who is aimless in life, and she gets a new neighbor, and the neighbor has a baby, and she asks the young woman to look after her baby. The young woman discovers the baby is actually just a doll, but to the mother, played by Jessica Biel, it is obviously a very real child that needs to be cared for. And the movie twists and turns. The music is gorgeous. It's a very sincere drama, very wonderfully acted and written. I love this movie, Truth About Emmanuel. Next up, I'm going to recommend Jim Jarmusch's wonderful romantic drama, Only Lovers Left Alive, about three vampires. Well, it's about a bunch of vampires, but three man vampires, Tom Hiddleston, Tilda Swinton, and deliciously wicked Mia Wasikowska. It's Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton's romance throughout the ages, culminating in modern day, and how there's this sort of sadness over them because they can't die, but they can't really experience life the same way they used to either. And, you know, it's about letting go of the past. It's about embracing the future and understanding the present. And I think there's something really beautiful about this movie. This was my first Jarmusch film in theaters, and I was very grateful to have that experience. And then finally, my final recommendation for the year is the controversial, maybe you shouldn't watch it, Nymphomaniac Volumes 1 and 2, directed by Lars von Trier. This was like the moment that Graham and I became really good friends, was we saw Nymphomaniac together at the tower. There were only like five other people there, but we were both laughing our heads off and nobody else was. And I was like, okay, this guy can hang for sure. I think he felt the same way about me. But yeah, it's a very strange, dark comedy about a woman's journey through her sexuality over the years. And she is played wonderfully by two different actresses, Charlotte Gainsbourg and Stacey Martin. And yeah, it's told through flashbacks, flash forwards. It gets really self-indulgent for a second.
Just a bit.
But it also compares the sexuality of men and the draw of men to women to the geometrical formula for how to cast the perfect fly for a fish. And it does it with little diagrams like you're in school again. And I don't know, I think that's kind of funny. Yeah, a really fucked up ending too. But yeah, I love Nymphomaniac. I think it's one of Von Trier's best projects. Shia LaBeouf went crazy making these movies, which is fun. We're still dealing with that years later. We are still dealing with that as of today.
We are still living history, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know where Nymphomaniac fits in the grand scheme.
What should my obscure recommendation for the year be? Have you seen The Tale of Princess Kaguya? You must.
No, I haven't, but it's been on the watch list for a while.
Andrew.
You get two chalk marks today. Isn't that nice?
Wow. Some sort of record Ding! Going on today. But a lot of people know the Studio Ghibli. They know Miyazaki's work. A lot of people don't know of Isao Takahata's work. He did The Grave of the Fireflies. I think that's what he's most famous for. But The Tale of the Princess Kaguya is his last film. He passed away in 2018.
Yep.
And this is an extraordinary 5-star perfect experience. I don't think movies get this good. I recently rewatched this one as well, and I'll admit I had something like a religious experience at the end. I swear I was bawling, and that never happens. I don't bawl when I watch films.
How long is this movie?
Just over 2 hours.
It
is life-affirming and gorgeous. There is no other film that looks like this. The animation is done with watercolor. You owe it to yourself if you love animation, and especially if you love the work of Studio Ghibli, to check out The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. It is easily one of their best pieces. Honestly, 2013 seemed like a great year for film.
Yeah. Looking through this, it was really fun to see how many movies I saw this year and how many I loved. I mean, we didn't even mention Her, Wolf of Wall Street. There are just a lot of great movies from this year.
And I'm going to the theater and seeing all of them. Yeah, I went to the theater a lot with my friends this year. I do miss that.
Do you not still go often?
I don't. I mean, I was in college at this time, and I was roommates with people who, you know, we were just going to see movies all the time. And now all of those friends have kind of faded away from my life, or we're not as close. We just don't find the time to get together, and definitely don't have like the extra time to just be like, hey, what's playing down the Megaplex? Let's go see what's going on there. So, okay, we got to transition.
I know.
Amongst the great films coming out this year, we're going to talk about one of the more obscure ones. Something that I hadn't realized slipped into the cinematic canon of 2013, and that is Alejandro Jodorowsky's autobiographical The Dance of Reality. Andrew, you got the plot?
So, The Dance of Reality is an autobiographical film about the childhood of the film's director, Alejandro Jodorowsky, in 1940s Chile. We follow Jodorowsky as he meets different characters throughout the world who inspire his imagination, his fear, his courage, and his future. Throughout the film, Alejandro Jodorowsky himself comes in and reflects on his past, and even speaks to his past self in moments of grief, reminding his younger self that everything he will become, he already is. The film turns its focus to Jaime Jodorowsky, played by Jodorowsky's son, Brontes. He is Alejandro's father. He beats his son and his wife and doesn't believe in God, although he and his family are constantly harassed for their Jewish heritage. Jaime is a part of a communist group who wishes to overthrow the current president, Carlos Ibáñez del Campo. Jaime infiltrates Ibáñez's personal home to care for his horse, Bucéfalo. Jaime poisons Bucéfalo even after he comes to care for the horse. But when Ibáñez is grieving, Jaime is overcome with emotion and is unable to shoot him. He then leaves, is captured by Nazis, and tortured, but does not give any information. When the government is overthrown, Jaime is rescued and returns to his family a changed man. The film weaves historical fact in timelines that can't be possible and presents metaphorical images as reality. It is a commentary on our memories and dreams and how they form over time to make our reality and how we are in charge of how our reality is formed.
Perfectly stated, honestly. And this is a hard film to sum up.
Right.
As you might expect from any Alejandro Jodorowsky film, who we last visited in 1973 when we did our episode on The Holy Mountain.
That was literally a year ago that we did that episode.
Weird.
And it was 5 years ago to the date of recording. We were recording this on September 21st that I saw Endless Poetry in theaters.
Weird.
The Dance of Reality, baby. Endless Poetry is the sequel to Dance of Reality. I guess I should establish that. And that's how I saw Dance of Reality. I saw Endless Poetry first, because even though Endless Poetry had no marketing behind it and was completely crowdfunded and was only in theaters for 5 days, I somehow heard about it and not Dance of Reality. I still am not quite sure how that math works, but I saw Endless Poetry in theaters and cried and said this might be his best movie. I still stand by that. And then found out it was a sequel and said, oh boy, I've got to go see the first one. Then I sought out the first one and I cried and said, wow, this is like his most impressive project. Hope he gets to finish it. Womp womp. He still might, but we'll talk about that later. So this was a great movie to get to watch thinking that Jodorowsky was kind of done. And I mentioned in the Holy Mountain review that I'd seen all of his movies when I was a little younger, and it was just incredible to have this person who in my mind was a master of cinema return in my later years, and I was able to actually interact with his art while it was present, while it was being released. That just felt incredible. It was like if Bergman had released a film this year or something, you know, like someone who you hold in that type of reverence. It just felt so miraculous, and I was so grateful to be a part of it.
Because didn't Jodorowsky disappear for like 20 years? Not disappear, but he was not making films for a couple decades.
Right. He didn't make films for 23 years after what some people call him selling out to Hollywood, which I would kind of agree with. He definitely sold out to bigger studios for a little while, but then made Santa Sangre, and that was another huge personal, weird, artistic, metaphorical movie, and it flopped and did not impress at the time, although now it's considered one of his best. And so he decided film was not calling for him. So he stopped making them, and he made his own tarot deck and a huge text about the tarot, which is highly regarded today. He, in general, became more of a theater director and book writer after Santa Sangre, and then it was during the creation of Jodorowsky's Dune that him and the producer Michel Sudeau, who had produced his earlier works, they reunited while that documentary was being created. And Jodorowsky had mentioned, I have this idea for an autobiographical film based off of my autobiography, The Dance of Reality. And after pitching it to Michel Sadou, Michel said, I would really like to collaborate with you again. And that's how this movie came to be.
Bada bing, bada boom. Personally, I find it beautiful that someone like Jodorowsky is not just a filmmaker. He is an artist who can make whatever he wants, all sorts of stuff. Comic books. Go out and make a beautiful comic book. Go out and become a mime. Do it all. I know he started off as a mime in Paris early in his career or something like this.
That's true. I have to ask this out of curiosity. Did you revisit the Holy Mountain episode before we recorded this?
I did.
I don't want to completely retread old ground, so I'm kind of trusting you to help us steer in that direction. I'll bring the facts about this movie. You help me not repeat myself too much.
It is funny. In our Holy Mountain episode, you basically just recite the plot of this film, The Dance of Reality, to describe Jodorowsky's early childhood. You do preface it by saying that this is his autobiography. Like, this is what he tells us happened. It's probably not true. Probably all made up. He's a storyteller. Clearly, you listen to interviews with Jodorowsky and you're like, oh, this guy is weaving an intricate tale. I don't know what to believe.
Yeah, I mean, all of my information about his childhood comes from that book and this movie. So, that's where it came from. You're getting to see the source of my libel on this podcast.
In our Holy Mountain episode, I say that it will take me a while to digest the Holy Mountain. It is an experience and then some. Comparing the Holy Mountain to Dance of Reality, you can tell they're made by the same person. There is a surrealist quality, and there are images and themes that reflect, and it makes sense. However, Holy Mountain is a film about the human experience, the experience that is felt within politics, religion, evolution. It feels like the scope is a lot bigger. Whereas I really like Dance of Reality because it is a lot more focused. It is a lot more centered on one person and their experience. And the artist, Jodorowsky, is focusing on himself and his childhood and his memories. And although that might feel a little self-indulgent at times, I think that this is a lot more approachable than something like The Holy Mountain. That being said, I think The Holy Mountain is a magnum opus. It is a miracle that that movie works, and it has sat with me very well. I think it's incredible. But I think that I would say that Dance of Reality is a more general audience-friendly film, and it's not friendly to the general audience.
I would agree. I think these, being Dance of Reality and Endless Poetry, are good movies to get modern audiences potentially interested in Jodorowsky, because if you can't handle what's in this, you ain't ready for The Holy Mountain. But at the same time, it really doesn't pull any punches. But this movie has a real emotional resonance with me. I think that the scope of the plot might be smaller, and the scope of possibly the ambition is smaller than Holy Mountain, but at the same time, I think the emotional depth he reaches and the way he's reflecting on his life as an 84-year-old man, there's something about this movie that speaks to me on a deeper level than The Holy Mountain, and I love them both. I mean, I absolutely adore them both, but this movie, it just feels like a message to humanity, a message to people of the earth to hold on and to keep going and to not stop fighting for the things and the people you love. And there's something about that that I find really endearing, and that it doesn't come across as saccharine or preachy is a miracle. I mean, this movie feels like it's trying to touch your soul, and I appreciate art that's trying to do something grander than what the medium is known for as a whole.
Just last week, we were talking about how earnest Cloud Atlas felt, how in a world where everyone is cynical and trying to subvert expectations or do this and that, just to bare your heart and be honest with your audience is such a brave act as an artist. And it's very hard to do because, yeah, it can come off as really cheesy if it isn't handled well. But I'm totally with you, man. This film feels so heartfelt and beautiful. And I just love it that the director Jodorowsky, is appearing and comforting his main character and just saying, like, it's going to be all right. Just keep going. And that's like the most relatable part of this film. Like, if I could go back in time and like give my younger self a hug and be like, it's going to be okay. It's not going to turn out how you expect, but it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Like that is my big takeaway from this film, my big emotional resonance. Even though we're talking about someone growing up in Chile in the 1940s and having a completely different life experience, I still feel like this film is so relatable because it's talking about something universal in the progression of growing up as a human being.
There is something about an unknown wish fulfillment of seeing the 84-year-old version of yourself grabbing you and holding you and saying, hold on. Like, I don't, that image speaks to me so much. There's a moment where Alejandro, as a very young child, is mocked by the other kids when they discover he has a circumcised penis. And even though he's only 12 or 13 at the time, he's considering jumping off of these rocks that he knows will kill him. It feels like he's saying, this is a real experience I had, was I was contemplating suicide at a very young age. And Yudorovsky himself, as the 84-year-old man, just comes from behind him and holds him and says, don't jump, don't do it. And there's something about that that, I don't know, I always, like, it makes me be like, 84-year-old Andrew is, like, already reaching down and being like, it's gonna be okay, man. Like, you just gotta keep holding on.
Andrew, usually it is my task to find the review that encompasses the general thoughts or a counterpoint to the consensus of the time period, but you had a strong inclination to talk about this video essay. You want to talk a little bit about that?
I really like this review. I sort of fell in love with this YouTuber for a little bit. This is YMS. That is short for Your Movie Sucks. He started off as sort of like an edgy YouTuber who was just coming for movies that a lot of people like that he didn't. And he would, you know, present these things against the movie. That was really popular. But somewhere around 2012, 2013, right around the same time as Lindsay Ellis becoming very big and other people on YouTube sort of turning to video essays for positive film critique, he also started reviewing films that he liked. And ever since he has switched to that, I have found not only his positive reviews more endearing, but now whenever he does do a negative takedown of a movie, it is always something that feels absolutely deserved. Like, for instance, his most recent one was the Lion King remake from 2019. He doesn't seem to be as edgy now, and I feel like he's become a more softer, easier to listen to critic, and I really enjoy his opinions. And he's the only person who I've been able to find who made a YouTube video about this movie that seems to speak to what the film is actually attempting to do. And he even starts off the video by saying, this isn't a recommendation for everybody because a lot of you won't like this. For me, as everyone who's listened to all the episodes knows, I really fell out of love with criticism and movie critics in general. I just really decided I hated everything about it. But now that we're in this era where anyone can get on YouTube and make a video essay about a movie that they're passionate about, I've sort of come back around because I find these opinions way more enlightening and interesting to listen to, even if I disagree with them. I like that this review isn't coming from a critic who's getting paid to watch 20 movies a week or has to see so many movies at the festival and report on them. This review is coming from someone who's very passionate about the filmography of Yudorovsky and is very excited to see a film from him after all of these years. And other reviews you read of this movie don't seem to carry that same perspective and weight. And I think I see a lot of myself in this review. Did you have any opinions on this review?
I also really like Your Movie Sucks, YMS, on YouTube, and I've been following him for a little while, too. I remember when he was just making video essays that were takedowns of popular films. And it feels like that sentiment is what really started the whole YouTube or internet criticism craze. It was people like The Nostalgia Critic or Red Letter Media. I think the big one that really got this whole trend going was in 2009 when Red Letter Media put out their feature length review of Star Wars Episode One that was so influential that you cannot help but watch a film like The Force Awakens and think that, oh, they are just responding to this internet review of the prequels. Very strange. But yes, this project, A Century in Cinema, has been following films from the beginning of the medium, but we've also been in parallel steps sort of following the evolution of film criticism, which has been pretty interesting in and of itself. And it's always fun to see how that has changed over the years. I remember when we looked at Rotten Tomatoes back in 2000
for Miscongeniality. I won't let you forget, and I won't forget when you made me do that.
But I think this is a perfect review to encapsulate how film criticism is evolving into the 2010s, because I don't read film reviews. I don't do that anymore. I don't think a lot of people do. I mean, for myself, I listen to podcasts. I listen to Kermode and his take. And I think a lot of people, yeah, gravitate towards things like this. Video essays and internet personalities, people they trust online to tell them about films and what to see.
Yeah. And I'm just happy something like this exists. I mean, this has over 200,000 views on YouTube. Another interesting fact was that it has, even though as far as his audience goes on a widespread international scale, I feel like there are probably more people who pay attention to Mark Kermode who are paying attention to film criticism than Your Movie Sucks. But he has over 200,000 more views than Mark Kermode's video on the same movie. And it's hard to gauge at this point. Today, I think I would agree with you. But I think in 2013, it was a little harder to gauge of where exactly is this heading. And I have to say, I'm grateful for the progress. And it was worth those shitty years of film criticism to now get just an abundance of, you know, hot takes, cold takes, but people just talking about movies they love on YouTube. I genuinely love it, and I can't wait to see where it goes next.
Well, Andrew, we are definitely not out of the era of Rotten Tomatoes. Rotten Tomatoes is still holding a firm grip on film criticism, in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess it's just a matter of what you're paying attention to. But I don't think it's anywhere near as popular as it used to be.
I don't think so either. But you just lent me a Blu-ray of Parallel Mothers, and smack dab on the front cover of that Blu-ray, certified fresh, baby.
You know that I actually completely mentally block that out. I don't see it on any of my Blu-rays. I don't know where it is. I don't know what it looks like.
But from a general audience point of view, I think Rotten Tomatoes still holds quite a bit of sway, but we have all got our niche. We all have our YouTubers and our internet personalities that we come back to and we trust.
God, for some people, it's us.
Oh my God, are we a continuation of modern film criticism? Oh my. Well, I don't like that kind of responsibility.
Yeah, you do. You've been doing it for a while. We're over 2 years now. I mean, there were breaks, but we've been doing this for over 2 years. Yeah, the entire production of this film took place in Chile. And he notoriously cast a bunch of people who lived in his childhood town of Tocopilla to be in the film. Most of the actors in the movie are non-actors. He went to the town, pretty much said, here is the budget. Here is how much people are getting paid for being a part of this. This is what I want to do. The goal was to be as hands off as possible with the town itself. He didn't want to do any damage. So to get around making huge sets or having to potentially tear things down, instead, he very cleverly just puts big cardboard painted things on top of other things. And you might be thinking that sounds a little theatrical and ridiculous, but this movie is theatrical and ridiculous.
It all fits.
So it gets away with it very easily. So these sets, although they are obviously artificial, work very well for the tone the movie is setting, as well as leaning into the themes of this being an older man revisiting himself as a young child. It is also being made in an older world, revisiting a younger version of itself. There were certain moments when I watched it with Arthur where he would point out, like, oh, I didn't even realize, like, the tank. You're like, I didn't even realize the tank was just two big cardboard flats on two sides of, like, a car.
I loved that. Yeah.
Looks great. It totally sells the whole story.
I don't know if it looked great. It just, it didn't matter. It was like, I was so focused on what was going on that I was like, oh, my God, it's just cardboard in the background.
I think there are things that don't look great in this movie. I think the CGI birds don't look great. And I think the day for night shooting is very painfully obvious. This is his first film that he made digitally. And I think his understanding of that medium is still coming into fruition, which is why I, one of the reasons I do prefer Endless Poetry and why I think it's such a great movie is because it is also digital, but he has figured it out. And that movie looks like a movie. But as you said, I agree. It's so obvious to see what he's trying to do. And there's so much of the film that you can just see the nails and the hammers, and you can just see the whole production, that it all sort of works. And you're like, okay, I get what you're trying to tell me visually. And what you're trying to tell me visually is very ambitious, creative, and beautiful. So I'm going to roll with it.
Like you said, it's theatrical. And the Brechtian theater aspect of Jodorowsky films, well, we went into that in our Holy Mountain episode. We love that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit in our Cloud Atlas episode.
We have planned out this whole thing. This entire project is scripted.
That would be insane if we revealed that and it was true. That would be insane. So something I do think is very interesting is that Brontës Jodorowsky plays his own grandfather, Jaime Jodorowsky, in this film. And even more interesting that he works with his father again.
Mm-hmm.
So Brontës Jodorowsky, he was the 7-year-old boy in El Topo. He's notoriously naked that entire film. And he also is a young naked child in The Holy Mountain. And then when Jodorowsky was going to make Dune, he kind of tortured his son. He forced his son to go to this martial arts instructor 6 days a week for 7 hours a week. And Brontës' own words was that it was torture and abusive. And the instructor was very tough on him. He sort of gave up years of his life as a child for this vision of his father's that never, you know, never came to be. The movie was never made.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they had a pretty major falling out with each other. And Brontës more or less said, I'm never working with you again. And while that documentary was being made, initially the interviews with Alejandro and Brontës had to be filmed separately. However, to the keen eye, you will notice that near the end of the film, they are being interviewed together. And that's because during the production of the film, they had a nice meeting and they talked. And it was sort of a therapeutic moment for them of, you know, Alejandro having to own up to his mistakes and Brontës having to accept his apology. Then, after the making of the documentary, Alejandro Jodorowsky confronted Brontës and said, I would like for you to play Jaime, who is essentially the main character of this film. And Brontës agreed to it. And a part of the making of the film was that Brontës got to call the shots on what he did, how it was done. He was in control of the stunts that he was involved in, the torture scene that he films. He was in charge of how long he was hanging from things. Like, he was in charge of pretty much every moment he was on screen. Alejandro would tell him what the vision is, what they were doing, and then Brontës got to pretty much say yes or no to whether he would do it or not.
Even that one scene?
Even what one scene?
The one scene.
I mean, I'm telling you what they have said. They don't What's crazy is that in all of the interviews about this movie, in all of the special features I can find, in all of the reviews I read of this movie, no one will mention anything about that scene. Should we break the cycle?
No.
You don't want to?
No.
Oh. I do. It's weird. It's almost like a sacred thing because the people who have seen this
movie, you're not supposed to talk
about it.
Don't
want to scare anyone away.
You're not supposed to talk about it, Andrew.
I'm doing it. I've always been a rebel. So there is a sequence in this film where Jaime has decided that he hates the way the government is treating this leper colony. Their plight is desperate and horrifying. And he goes to them and tries to bring them water, but instead they eat the donkeys that he brings to them. They take the water, and he is thrown into the gaggle of lepers and essentially comes down with leprosy himself. And so he walks home, and everyone's washing the street where he's just walked, and he goes to the shop that his wife owns. His wife, she sings every line of dialogue that she has. The actress herself is a professionally trained opera singer. And she would just sing live on set. The score that's backing up her voice was added later. It was structured around what she was singing off the cuff, which I think is so impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But she delivers a very powerful aria where she is praying to God to heal her husband. And the climax of this aria is her lifting up her skirt and pissing all over her husband while singing a high note. And I'm not kidding. It really is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen in a movie. My jaw was on the ground the first time I watched the film because I just couldn't believe something like this even existed. Now I always give a heads up. I gave a heads up to Arthur, too. I always just say, okay, this is the really crazy part, because I feel like it's the one part of the movie that I love so much, but also I feel could turn an audience away. And it's not like human excrement being something sacred is new ground for Yodorovsky. I mean, there's that entire sequence in The Holy Mountain where he turns the man's feces into gold in front of him, you know? Like, this is a common thing where he finds bodily fluids and human waste to be something that is praised to a certain extent, as opposed to being completely disgusted by. I'm kind of on board with it from a mental state. I do think it's strange that these are things we do every single day, every single one of us does once or twice a day, yet we never talk about it in our art. But Yodorovsky does. I mean, again, he doesn't say it specifically, but Brontës did have final say in what he would do for the movie, and he knew that scene was coming, so I'm assuming he was like, yes, I will do this.
That's all we can assume. It's a startling moment, though.
It is a shocking moment that it's so easy to look at it and just say this is purely for shock value. But it also is the moment where Jaime's true transformation begins. So it does hold significant value within the plot as well.
Yeah. So like I said, there are moments that rhyme with things that you'll recognize from other Yodorovsky films.
Pamela Flores, she is just amazing in this role. Her voice is incredible. Alejandro Yodorovsky has said that his mother always wanted to be an opera singer and never got the chance to do it. But whenever she would talk to him or would ask him to open the shop or anything, she always had sort of a sing-song nature to her voice. These are his words. He wanted a trained opera singer with huge breasts like his mother to play this role. And he definitely found one.
That he did.
And her performance is amazing. Her performance gets even crazier in Endless Poetry. I'm excited for you to see that.
Ooh.
But yes, she gets to play two characters in that film.
Do you want to go into Endless Poetry? Connections to that?
Oh, well, first, I also want to mention that he has two other sons in this movie. Aiden Yodorovsky, who's his youngest son, he plays this anarchist who is kind of not really on board with communism either, but has joined this communist revolution, but ultimately is overwhelmed by the world and decides to kill himself. And then his other son, Cristóbal Yodorovsky, plays Theosophist, learning about God and the world from a mystical perspective, and he has this understanding that all religions are following the same God. Whether you believe in that or not is up to the viewer, but I like that his sons play this sort of brutal force of nature in his life, this catalyst for his father's change, and then this person who is responsible for his open-minded view of the world and religion. There's something nice about that.
Mm. I did write in my Letterboxd review of this film that I am just so grateful that I am not a part of this family.
Like the actual Yodorovskys or the family as depicted in the film?
Well, let's get into that.
Let's unpack that.
For one, my family's perfect. Love my family.
Oh.
And for two, so abusive. So abusive, the father in this film is. And I know that he goes on a spiritual journey and he repents and he's a better person by the end. But good Lord, it would not be great to grow up with him as your father. So that's the family in the film. But also, too, I mean, you kind of confirmed this, Yodorovsky having his son basically go through hell to make projects, not a cool thing. I'm glad to know that this film was a little bit better, that he ceded more control to Brontës. But yeah, there just seems to be a lot going on.
Well, I do think that's a reflection in the film, too, is that he sees the abuse of his father towards him as part of the reason that he ended up being abusive to his son as well.
That makes sense.
And this is his attempt to make amends with his son, who he abused. And through doing that in the film itself, he is attempting to forgive his father.
That makes sense.
Because when we forgive people, Arthur, it isn't for their sake. It's for ours.
You said he's the main character, and he is. He goes through the hero's journey for sure. And yeah, I was with him every step of the way. I loved him.
Yeah, the film sort of switches hands. The first part is Alejandro's story, but once his perceived growth of himself at that age is over, it turns to the story about his father. He's heard rumors and he's heard stories about his father's rebellion years and his communist ties, but the majority of this story is fictional as far as his father's story is concerned.
Allegedly, yeah.
Allegedly, it is fictional.
We don't know.
That's true.
We don't know.
This could. I mean, I hope this all happened verbatim, truly. What a poetic thing to happen
in your life.
Yeah, Bucephalo. We're all looking for the Bucephalo in our lives, this beautiful horse that we love so much we have to kill.
In a more traditional narrative film, it might be strange to switch up the protagonist halfway through, but it feels totally natural and something this surreal. No problem. Want to talk about endless poetry? We've been hinting at endless poetry.
Well, I didn't really go into...
Not the legal trouble, not dun, that, dun, but...
Dun.
Connections to Endless Poetry / legal trouble.
Yeah, I don't have much to say about Connections to Endless Poetry that I haven't already said. But what I will say is Endless Poetry was not produced by Michel Sadoux. Although Dance of Reality was a moderate success, it was still a huge financial risk and didn't quite recoup its costs. So there was no real producer for Endless Poetry. It was notoriously entirely funded by GoFundMe, which the film ends on this celebratory note of all of the different patrons who paid money for it on GoFundMe. However, there is a producer named Amir Abbas Nokaste who gave $200,000 to Endless Poetry and was expecting that to be paid back on certain contract terms. Yodorovsky's personal film production crew called Satori Films liquidated itself, and therefore it was sort of a loophole from things not needing to be paid, which I think is pretty sketchy practice. Yodorovsky is a great artist and a great director. I don't think that makes him necessarily, you know, a wonderful person to work with on a financial level, but because the production studio is liquidated, this lawsuit has turned into a personal lawsuit, and it's just the future of Yodorovsky in film is looking a little bleak right now.
Ugh.
And that does kind of make me sad, because there is a part of me that wants so badly for there to be a next film in this autobiographical series. But there's a stronger part of me being like, you signed a contract, dude. And I don't know a lot of things, but I do know Yodorovsky has $200,000. I know that. He's even done these weird interviews where he says, I don't want to use my money to pay for something like that. I want to use my money to invest in my family and my art, blah, blah, blah. Essentially admitting that he could just pay this off. but he doesn't want to. And I think that's a little sad. Yep. He made this documentary that I actually own because it came in a box that Arrow DVD did a huge Blu-ray release of his movies from the 70s. And then also his most recent film, which is called Psycho Magic. And it's a documentary about alternative medicine. And I don't know why, but I just don't want to watch it. I like Yodorovsky. I like him as a view of the world and in perspective. I think seeing his methods in actual practical practice on people in the world is something I'm not ready for and something that I think would make me hate him. Does that make sense?
We don't want to see how the sausage
Do
is
you,
made.
Would you go to Yodorovsky as your personal doctor?
I would not go to Yodorovsky for almost anything except for a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you listen to interviews with him and he doesn't seem real. He seems like a troll you met under the bridge who's like telling you stories and you're entranced. But I mean, I don't think I'd trust him with $200,000.
Right.
I don't know what that troll imp is going to do. Yeah, so I'm not surprised. Not surprised to hear that.
I still have this little hope in my head that this will all get worked out and that he'll get to make at least one more film in this series, because I would very much like for there to be a film about him as a movie director and him meeting his wife and him having his own children and like showing the full cycle of his life from the perspective of Dance of Reality and his children. You know what I mean?
I get that.
It feels like there's a lot of good material there to work with. Maybe one of his sons will make it.
Exactly.
So we never really know exactly what's going to happen next, but you know, I look forward to it. The man is about to be 95. So he says that he wants to live to be 300 years old.
I also hope he gets to make one more movie. But I'm going to be happy if the last film is Endless Poetry, which I still haven't seen.
The last film is Psycho Magic.
Oh, fuck.
That's what I'm saying.
Final thoughts. Final thoughts.
I love this movie. You mentioned your Letterboxd review. I actually decided to turn the page on my Letterboxd review of this and make this a 5-star movie after this most recent revisit. This movie makes me feel good. Like, this movie makes me feel like I'm really not trying to get like dark or anything, but like legitimately, this movie is attempting to give its audience a reason to live and to go on. And I feel it every time I watch it. And I like that encouragement. I like it a lot. So I appreciate this film so much and it means a lot to me. And I know I'll be watching it multiple times again. I've now watched it twice this year and I always follow it up with Endless Poetry. And I haven't watched Endless Poetry once this year. So I'll probably watch Endless Poetry once before I watch it with you. Just so I've seen them both still the same amount of times.
Do what you gotta do, man.
I will. I will do that. What are your final thoughts?
Just like The Holy Mountain, I feel like this has to sit with me before I come to any sort of conclusion. Didn't we just do this with Cloud Atlas? Nonetheless, it is an extraordinary film, but I haven't reached my final conclusion, like my final thought on it. It's still digesting. I only saw this 2 days ago.
Yes.
And there's a lot going on.
The last 4 films we've watched have all been very, very deep dives into the human psyche in very different ways.
I keep telling people what we're watching and they're like, what?
Because these films haven't had the same amount of time to become classics.
That's right. Like Twilight.
Like Twilight.
We are in the contemporary era of film history. And honestly, I've seen a lot of the films that might be classics on, I think.
You never know.
But you never know. Such as Noah. We don't know if Noah is going to be a classic in 50 years.
I'm going to be revisiting Noah and Mother for this next episode.
From the director Darren Aronofsky. And this is the story of Noah.
But not quite how you've been told it before. So to our regular listeners, this is the end of our episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you would like more A Century in Cinema, please join our Patreon. The link for that is in the show notes and on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is called A Century in Cinema. We just do little post discussions there. We have a good time. We're pretty laid back. You've heard this spiel before. If you listened to the episodes before this, you already know what the Patreon is. So what's holding you back from joining it? It's super fun. We get really positive feedback on it. People love it.
And this week we're talking about Disney's live-action remakes that are coming out around this time. Which ones are Andrew's favorites? Spoiler, none of them.
And thank you so much to Nathan Royal for our show's music. We very much appreciate it. And thank you, Arthur.
Thank you, Andrew. Good recommendation.